Our reading today is from the martyred El Salvadorian Archbishop Oscar Romero. He wrote this as a pastoral letter to his priests who were beginning to be murdered in El Salvador. It helps, now and then, to step back and take a long view. The kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it is even beyond our vision. We accomplish in our lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete, which is a way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals or objectives includes everything. This is what we are about. We plant the seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces far beyond our capacities. We cannot do everything, and there is a sense of liberation in that. This enables us to do something, and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it is a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter and do the rest. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders. Ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future not our own. Amen. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, a day set aside by Hallmark, florists, and candy makers everywhere to celebrate love, and specifically to celebrate a specific kind of love, Eros, that love between sweethearts or lovers or longtime spouses who just perhaps still fall into one of the first two categories. It's a day where we honor one kind of love, romantic love, above all others. And it's also a day when Unitarian Universalists celebrate a campaign called Standing on the Side of Love. As I heard the story from Bill Sinkford, who was then the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, musicians, including one named Jason Shelton, were meeting in Bill's office when word came down that then-President George Bush had just called for a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. The meeting was interrupted so Reverend Sinkford could draft a response for the media. One of the phrases he used was, "We stand on the side of love." Jason Shelton writes that he began writing the song immediately. Now, the song has given name to a political campaign that focuses primarily on two issues, same-sex marriage and immigration reform. But what does it mean to stand on the side of love? What do love and justice have to do with one another anyway? The ancient Greeks gave us three different words for love, which are still in use today to describe different types of love. Traditionally, eros refers to a romantic or passionate love. This is the kind of love we mean when we say they fell in love. It's that zingy kind of feeling when you see your beloved and you just want to touch them. It's that gloriously distracting kind of love. In a long-term relationship, eros often extends and transforms, at least in part, into another type of love. Historically, the other two types of love are philia, which I've always taken to mean familial kind of love. It's that kind of love that one feels for friends and family and community. It's a virtuous love, rooted in equality and caring. Aristotle said that one or both parties benefit from this type of love. It's the kind of love that keeps families and communities connected, working towards a common goal. Agape is the kind of love that is most often thought of in connection with God or divinity. It's that selfless kind of love, pure and idealized. Agape is a love where you want what's best for the other person, whether or not that includes you. I think one of my favorite examples of agape in a human relationship is the story of Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court Justice. Her husband John had Alzheimer's at the relatively young age of 77. She stepped down from the court to care for him, and eventually he went into a care facility for people who had Alzheimer's. As is fairly common for people with this disease, he forgot that he was married. He forgot who his spouse was. And then he fell in love with a woman named Kay, who lived in the facility with him. I can't know all of the emotions Justice O'Connor felt, seeing her husband swinging on the porch swing, holding hands with another woman, gazing into her eyes. But at least publicly, she's happy about this. Happy her husband is at peace and has found some pleasure in his life. As her son reported, "Mom was thrilled that Dad was relaxed and happy and comfortable living here and wasn't complaining." But let's go back to Eros for a bit, and not just because it's Valentine's Day tomorrow. Plato, who was the ancient Greek philosopher who first gave us these handy definitions, redefined his own vision of Eros. He said that although it's initially felt for a person, with contemplation, it becomes an appreciation of the beauty within the person, or even becomes appreciation of beauty itself. Eros helps the soul recall knowledge of beauty and contributes to an understanding of spiritual truth. Lovers and philosophers are all inspired to seek truth by Eros. Frederic Frère, in a book called Living and Value, which I will tell you is one of the densest and least understandable books I ever had to read in seminary, posited a theory that, in its overly simplified form, effectively said that evil is anything which thwarts beauty in the world. The world wants to evolve into beauty, and it is each of our responsibilities to create beauty in the world. Evil can be either unintentional, kind of a benign neglect of the landscape, or failing to develop a talent that would add beauty to the world. And evil can be intentional, and this is what we more often think of as evil: killing or harming people, destruction of property or the landscape, or even vandalism. So if Eros, looked at through the lens of contemplation, contributes to our understanding of beauty, and if evil is that which thwarts beauty, then we begin to understand one way that justice, which is a direct opposite of evil, in my opinion, and love are linked. But a more important way is through the lens of agape. 1 Corinthians verses 4 through 6 are the ones we know by heart from wedding ceremonies. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. But the part that I want to highlight today is the next two verses. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. This is the kind of love that's linked with justice, and it's not just the kind of love that's quiet and retiring. This is the kind of love that is loud and bold and sometimes angry. It's the kind of love that stands up and says, "No, this is wrong. This is unjust. This is not okay." This is the kind of love that takes action. And it's the kind of love that lets the oppressed know that they are not alone in the world. Elie Wiesel writes of the time that the concentration camp that he lived in as a child was liberated. As an American officer entered the place and witnessed the ovens, the starved prisoners, he began cursing and screaming. In his righteous anger, Wiesel writes, humanity re-entered the camp. This is the kind of love that led Martin Luther King Jr. to stand up and say, no more. Cornel West, a professor at Princeton, said of MLK, he knew he wasn't Jesus, though he was a follower of Jesus. And he was willing to pick up that cross and say, I understand that justice is what love looks like in public, and deep democracy is what justice looks like in practice. I'm going to die with my cross out of love connected to justice, trying to democratize not just America, but American imperialism in Vietnam. I'm with the children. I'm with the victims of this criminal slaughter of these precious people. And he was with the poor, and he was with the sanitation workers. And I love that Cornel West said deep democracy and not just democracy. Democracy, when contrasted with dictatorship, is indeed a very powerful thing. Look at Egypt. 18 days of protests, of the kind of protests that lead to martyrdom, the kind of protests that lead to governments coming after protesters with fire hoses and guns and armed riot police, the kind of protest where to march is to risk something real, the kind of protest that happened in Selma and Montgomery, and the kind of protest that happened in Tiananmen Square, and the kind of protest that happened in Phoenix if your skin was brown and you really had something to risk. That's the kind of protest that happened in Egypt these last few weeks. The kind of protest that led an Egyptian woman who lives in Portland to say in the Willamette Week that if she were still in Cairo, she would encourage her husband and her sons to go protest, even though that meant she might not get them back, because there was something worth changing. That's the kind of movement this is. It's not all goodness and mercy and love. It's the hard kind of love. It's the love that stands up for justice, and it's the love that will not be turned back, and that's the kind of love that justice demands. President Obama, in a televised address, praised the Egyptian revolution. Egyptians have made it clear, he said, that nothing less than genuine democracy will carry the day. It was the moral force of nonviolence, not terrorism, not mindless killing, that bent the arc of history toward justice once more. I'm all in favor of the moral force of nonviolence. I'm all in favor of democracy. I think that the people of Egypt are hopeful that free and fair elections that give the people a voice will end the stranglehold of dictatorship that has kept Egypt from thriving. And I hope that their dreams of a better future come true, and that neither a military junta nor Islamic extremists take power. But here's the nasty truth about democracy, and why I love Cornel West's quote so much. Because sometimes the will of the people is just plain wrong. Now, I know that that may be as close to blasphemy as we come in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. What about our fifth principle? We believe in the democratic process, in our congregations, and in society at large. But sometimes the will of the people isn't just, and it isn't fair. Janice Longben can tell you something about that. A couple of years ago, she and her partner, Lisa Pond, took their three kids from their home in Olympia, Washington, to Florida to go on a cruise. They were looking forward to a family vacation. Instead, as they were boarding, Lisa collapsed. She was rushed to the hospital, but Janice and the kids weren't allowed into the trauma area. As they sat in the waiting room, frantically worried about their partner and their mom, Janice asked to see Lisa when the social worker came. And the social worker informed her that she was in an anti-gay city, in an anti-gay state, and that she shouldn't expect anything. She needed a healthcare proxy, which she had a friend from home fax to the hospital. How many of you have a healthcare proxy located where somebody else could come into your house and find it? I don't. They did. And it didn't do them any good. Finally, a surgeon came in and told Janice that her partner had had a brain aneurysm and that she was brain dead. The surgeon asked permission to do a procedure, which told Janice that the hospital had in fact received their paperwork. Janice asked to bring the children and go sit with her partner. This was denied. Janice and the kids got to see Lisa for 5 minutes as the Roman Catholic priest was performing the last rites. Then they were ushered out of the room, and Lisa died alone. Thirty states now have laws on the books saying that gay marriage is illegal. These laws weren't put there because gay rights advocates were pushing them. They were put there because judges in a few jurisdictions decided that keeping one class of people from getting married wasn't any more justifiable now than it was in 1967 when the law kept black people and white people from getting married. People panicked and passed laws, and in several cases changed constitutions to keep women from marrying women and men from marrying men. Is it democratic? Yes. Is it just? Hell no. Civil rights should never, ever be put up for a popular vote, because while the arc of the universe may bend toward justice, it is, my friends, a very long arc. And sometimes the pace of changing hearts and minds is just too damn slow. But instead, what would happen if we looked at justice through the lens of love? Would some people have health care while others died of easily treatable diseases? Would some people be able to get married while others could not? Would children languish in foster care because same-sex couples aren't able to adopt? Would we ever, ever call another human being illegal? Would people be sent back to countries they have little connection to when they've lived here for years and worked hard and paid taxes? I don't think so. And I believe that love and justice and the agape kind of love and justice are linked because this kind of justice-making love doesn't just work with people we know. This kind of justice doesn't work if you only care about gay marriage because of your sister and her partner, or immigration because of your neighbor Jose down the street. That's a great place to start, and it's what's gotten us this far. But the truth is that sometimes justice demands that we simply look through the lens of love at everyone. Look through the lens of love at the homeless man on the street, or the hungry children in another country, or the person risking deportation at the Del Monte plant. Justice is what love looks like in public. Today and every day, may we look at the world through the lens of love and do what is demanded of us by that greater love which will not let us go. May it be so, and amen.